You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume, drink responsibly.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com. This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome to HRN on Tour. This is Christine Sykes Lowe, and today I'm joined by one of my hometown culinary heroes, Mirwan Irani. Mirwan is a chef and restaurateur changing the perception of Indian food in America through his growing restaurant and spice empire in the South's most essential culinary cities. He is a leading voice in the industry's conversation around diversity and cultural exchange. In 2022, Mirwan's flagship restaurant in Asheville, Chai Pani, was named Outstanding Restaurant by the James Beard Foundation. Mirwan was named by Time Magazine as one of the 31 people changing the South and is a 5-time James Beard Foundation Award semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast. Yeah.
Sounds so surreal when you say all that out loud.
Yes, that is you.
It's not read back to me that way. I love it.
It's awesome. And hello, I'm so glad we could connect in our own hometown. I know we ran into each other in Aspen, and it was a million miles an hour out there, and you had a lot going on. But tell me about your past several months, because not only did you have that huge event to attend, but obviously the James Beard Awards. So how was your experience with that? I mean, congratulations.
Thank
what
you.
A huge honor.
Thank you. It's been pretty intense. The best word I can use to describe it is intensity. Got dialed up and everything. I mean, we were doing all these things before the James Beard Awards, and all the awards did was sort of dial up the pressure, the attention, expectations, our own internal drive to just excel at everything we do, to look around and say, are we doing enough? Can we be doing more now that there's a spotlight on us? So, of course, incredibly exciting, incredibly privileged and honored, but also a little stressed out right now.
Well, you're keeping up with the demand. So I know you're making some adjustments with, kitchens taking over to be able to supply the restaurant.
Yep.
That needs to have the people coming through that want to experience everything. And I know that you have a lot of other things going on, but I want to go back to James Beard Awards.
Sure.
Because to me, I would love you to walk me through that day when you were in the running for it. Did you have any idea that it was as close as it was that you would actually be getting the award? Was there any surprise element?
Oh, I was flabbergasted. and I'm not just being coy.
Yeah.
I mean, it took me a long time to get adjusted to the fact that I was even nominated to be Best Chef, as you mentioned.
Right.
And it took me a while to sort of like wear the mantle and go, I don't have to feel insecure about this. I am doing something with Indian food that's special and people are noticing, and it was a wonderful feeling to be acknowledged. But then to have the entire enterprise, the restaurant itself, to suddenly be named as an outstanding restaurant in the entire country, I didn't even know how to process it.
Right.
And but then I said to myself, okay, well, it's just a semi-finalist list. It's a broad list, and it's very sweet of the voting panel to include us and give us a mention. Then we get on the finalist list a few months later, and now I'm like my jaw's touching the floor, and I'm starting to get stressed out about
this. Real, yeah.
This is real, and why is this happening? It took a lot of self-examination because we don't spend a lot of time doing that. We're just busy doing what we do, running restaurants, making food, and like you said, just dealing with the masses outside. So when I did that self-reflection, I thought to myself, well, okay, it's even more wonderful that we made the finals list, but I don't have to worry about winning because there's just so many other fantastic other, you know, finalists on the list. And in my mind, I believe it's Parachute in Chicago was my favorite to win because of just the work they do and their presence in the community. It's a hometown hero. And then the day came and I was quite relaxed, actually, because I had convinced myself that we have made it this far, but, you know, we're not going to win for all the right reasons. I wasn't feeling nervous or anticipatory. I was feeling relaxed and, what's the word, accepting
right.
of the fact that just to be here was such an honor. So I got to tell you, when they said Chai Pani on the stage, I kind of blacked out from that moment until my speech was over. I was so convinced that we weren't going to win that I didn't even have my speech written until I was sitting in the chair in the audience, recognizing that if the one in the billion happens, I don't want to look like an idiot blithering on stage, you know, without having anything meaningful to say. So I'm sitting there typing in my iPhone while my wife is nudging me saying, honey, the awards are going on. Like, listen, pay attention. So yeah, needless to say, it was absolutely a stunning moment. It took me a few weeks to wrap my head around what had just happened, and more importantly, to kind of reflect on what had we done for us to win this award. How do we do more of it? How do we live up to the expectation and the standard? And I'm not just talking about food and service. I'm talking about, you know, what I mentioned in my speech was this idea that a restaurant should be bigger than the sum of its parts, that it should be bigger than what goes on inside the four walls, that matters more than ever in today's day and age.
The holistic view of it all.
Absolutely. Yeah. That if you're in the community but not off the community, then you're kind of doing a disservice to yourself and to your community. So there's been a lot of that self-reflection and a lot of deep thinking around where do we go from here?
Well, I think everybody was en route to Aspen for the Food and Wine Classic, and this had obviously happened right before.
Yep.
And I remember doing a little research because I thought I would run into you and Katie and a few other folks from Asheville. And I remember seeing the clip of you up on stage, and it was just such a humbling, beautiful thing to watch. And I encourage anybody to look it up because
Thank you.
What a great moment.
It was an amazing moment. Aspen felt like this extended after party.
Right.
Because you're right, it was immediately after the awards, and everybody that was in Chicago was also in Aspen.
Say, hey, I saw you. Yeah. I just saw you. So Time magazine awarded you as 31 People Changing the South, and that was back in 2018.
Right.
Another probably wow moment when they contacted you for that. And through their profile on you, they noted your work with the Supper Club series, Brown in the South. Mm-hmm. Can you go into a little detail on how that formulated and how that came about and maybe where it's going?
Sure. That was such an organic thing. It really started as a conversation. I was at the Oxford, SFA Symposium, Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium in Oxford, Mississippi, and my dear friend Vish Bhatt, who won the 2019 Best Chef South, was there and part of the hosting team. And at a moment when I looked at Vish and realized that, wait a minute, I see Vish as an Indian, and my lens through which I relate to him is as an Indian with another Indian, but I really think he's a Southerner first, and an Indian sort of, you know, secondary, like where he came from is secondary to who he is and where he's from. So I asked him that question. I said, Vish, do you think of yourself as an Indian that happens to live in the South, or do you think of yourself as a Southerner that happens to come from India? And without hesitation, he said, oh, I'm absolutely a Southerner, and that's a great question. And he said, how do you feel, Marwan? And for the first time in my life, I was challenged to really reflect on how much of my identity is based on where I am versus where I came from. And we talked long and deep into the night over many glasses of bourbon and recognized that it was a conversation worth having, not just for our sakes, but for the sakes of a lot of other people that look like us and generations to come of people that look like us. I mean, my kids growing up here in the South. And we included Chidi into the conversation and reached out to Asha Gomez and Chidi Kumar from Garland and Raleigh and Asha from the Third Space in Atlanta and a number of other young chefs and not so young, myself included. And I recognize that there's something happening here. Manith Chauhan, you know, has her iconic restaurant in Nashville.
What a lovely lady, by the way.
What an amazing person and personality.
Vivek, yeah.
And Vivek, exactly. Yeah. And then you've got Chidi in Raleigh and myself in Asheville and Asha in Atlanta and Vish in Oxford and like some of the most groundbreaking Indian chefs that were redefining not just Indian cuisine, but to a certain degree, their perception of Southern cuisine all happened to be in the South. That's not an accident. That's not a coincidence. So being food people, we said, let's all get together, have a dinner, invite our close friends and people that are interested in this conversation and talk about this. John T. Curated the event. He was, moderated the event. And that first dinner is when we realized that we're onto something. There's a whole bunch of people that have been asking themselves the same question. How much of your identity is based in where you are versus where you're from? And with the South in particular, for me, it seemed more relevant than any other part of the country. Because the South has a very strong identity, an old identity, and one with where people have a lot of feelings about it. And some of it's ugly, mm-hmm. and some of it's not. And
but facing it and taking it head on and
exactly.
exploring it and talking about it openly.
And talking about it. And that conversation was happening to a certain degree between the sort of historical residents of the South, between white and black, those conversations and that tension have been going on for a long time. But my question was, what about the new settlers of the South, the ones that showed up in the 20th and 21st century, the ones that look like me that are making this our home, that if we didn't actively also claim this place as ours, that the conversation would never extend beyond the history of the South. So in a funny way, the Brown of the South turned into an exploration of what does a region or part of the country look like when newcomers also claim it as theirs and contributed it. And that's what Brown of the South became. I guess it got enough coverage and attention and people talking to where, the feeling was that we were doing something important here and actually changing some of the perceptions of the South. Then COVID happened, and it kind of like everything came to a pause.
Yes, a screeching halt. And now we're starting to tiptoe back and maybe even run a little bit. And also, interestingly on that, how you're melding the flavors and the history of the South into your own regional culture.
Right.
So through the menus and what you're serving and, the restaurants.
Yeah, I just did this dinner with Vish, my friend who I talk about often, and we did this a couple nights ago in Atlanta, and his book is called I'm From Here. And again, the reason this dinner was really exciting to me because there was a juxtaposition of two lenses. Vish's lens is that of a Southerner interpreting his food through the lens of being an Indian. And I, here in Asheville, I feel like I'm still an Indian interpreting Southern food through the lens of being an Indian. It may seem like a, subtle difference, but it's a big difference. So the way I look at food and Chai Pani and what we're doing is it's very much rooted in my Indian upbringing. It's Indian cuisine. But I want to make sure that when you come to Chai Pani and have Indian cuisine in Chai Pani, that there's a distinct sense of place. That, yes, this restaurant didn't just arbitrarily plop itself in the middle of a town and is sort of, this bubble or this island in the city. When you walk in, I want you to feel like this restaurant could only exist in Asheville or in Atlanta, and it could only exist in this part of the country, and it only makes sense because of the way they work with, Southern concepts like Southern hospitality and Southern ingredients. I mean, our kale pakoras, our sweet potato masala, our green tomato fritters.
Delicious.
All delicious. Our okra fries. If you didn't know that this was an Indian restaurant and somebody gave you the menu out of context, you might not be, wrong in assuming it's a Southern restaurant.
Right.
So that's how I'm approaching food nowadays.
Well, you have a lot on your hands. You're co-founder, chef, and CEO of the Chai Pani Restaurant Group, which includes, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm missing anything, Chai Pani Asheville, Chai Pani Decatur, Badawala Atlanta, Badawala Charlotte, Buxton Hall Barbecue, Buxton Chicken Palace, Buxton Chicken Palace.
That's a tongue twister.
Yeah, let me say that again. And Nanny's Piri Piri Chicken in Atlanta. And correct. Then finally, Spice Brand Spice Walla.
Right.
Which is, I would say, probably that came about in the past 5 years, correct?
Yeah, 2018 was our first real year, yeah.
And it has two outposts in Asheville and Atlanta. So speaking of Spice Walla, I'd like to go into a little bit more on that because you had a pop-up recently at the Grove. And you have it going on. Mm-hmm. And what is your plan with that? First of all, how did it come about?
Right.
Spice Walla, the brand, and your plans going forward with it.
You know, most of the things in my life seem to come about serendipitously or accidentally. You know, it's like most of these restaurants, when you describe them, and I'm thinking back, how did we end up with Buxton Hall Barbecue? How did we open this? It always was, it was the right time, the right place, the right people, the right moment. And that's what happened with Spice Walla. Back in late 2017, I was approached by a distributor, Southern Foods, they were called at the time, that since then been acquired by a bigger company, Cheney Brothers, asking if I would help them with figuring out a way to get chefs that were looking for more global flavors in their spices, and we're looking to have a broader and wider range of spices than a distributor that distributes to restaurants would normally carry. Now, you and I can walk in a grocery store, and there's a world of spices there from A to Z from all over the world, but restaurants don't have access to that. They only have access to stuff a distributor is willing to carry, and a distributor will only carry what they think they can sell the most of. So they're not interested in the more exotic stuff where, you know, they'll only sell smaller quantities. But this company recognized that many restaurants and chefs were broadening their palates. Their audiences' palates were broadening, and were experimenting with, you know, a far wider range of flavor profiles and spices. So, long story short, I kind of got talked into starting a spice business to supply restaurants. And I guess the logic of the time was, I'm a chef, I'm a restaurateur, I understand both sides of the business. And also, my background, you know, lends me to really learn about spices the way anybody from any part of the world would learn about, you know, the ingredients that come naturally to them. And that's how it started, and that's all it was meant to be. But then, about 6 months in, folks started talking about this little spice company. They started seeing jars of spices in chefs' kitchens.
It got a lot of press.
Got like a lot of press.
Early on, it's amazing.
And started asking a lot of questions and wanted to buy spices for the home. So a series of people started showing up at our factory, our processing plant, asking them if we would sell spices in smaller home quantities. So I went ahead and developed a home line and collections for the home. And we put together and curated a collection called the 18 Essential.
Is that it right there?
That's it right there. Yep.
Yeah.
With the ultimate kitchen essentials. Yep. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that most people in their kitchen drawers have that 5-year-old jar of paprika or that 7-year-old jar of cumin that they've never thrown away because they just think it doesn't go bad. And the reality is that 5-year-old paprika and that 7-year-old cumin is tasteless, odorless, and is just doing nothing when you add it to your food. So we created a set, the idea being you could empty out your pantry and your drawer, throw away all those old spices, and put in 18 of the ones that you
need
the
most.
Would
you mind bringing this over here so I can explain it to the audience, to listeners?
This one's empty, but...
Yes, well, the actual prepackaged is the 18 spices, and it's everything from ground yellow mustard to smoked paprika.
And za'atar and everything in between.
Yes, everything in between. It's beautifully packaged.
Yeah, and the idea being that, you know, if you wanted to start from scratch, this is what you need to have at the very least in your pantry. Well, we launched that in 2019, and in the fall of 2019, Oprah, Her Majesty.
You know what? I don't know if I knew this. Maybe I did. Maybe that was one of the things I was like jaw-dropping over because, wow.
It was a wow moment. She put us on her list of Oprah's favorite things of 2019.
Gosh.
And as everybody that's ever watched TV and recognizes what they call the Oprah effect knows.
The list, yes.
The list. If you get on the list, you're just, you know, done for. And we were done for. I was airshipping 40,000 tins from China, paying an eye-watering amount of money just to get them in on time so that we could fulfill the orders that were coming through thanks to Oprah Winfrey. I don't think we made a penny on the deal because we were just throwing everything we had at it. But I was determined to not let a single Oprah fan not be able to buy her 18 pack of spices. And that kind of launched us into the next level. We grew by 4x again the year afterwards. the pandemic came along, everybody started cooking at home, and we kind of became, within certain circles, a household name. Mm-hmm. We got amazing write-ups from the Wall Street Journal to, you know, Bon Appetit magazine. And now we are in, oh my God, over 3,000 retailers. We're in Amazon, obviously. We sell to some big box suppliers like Costco and Walmart, and we still supply restaurants, over 1,000 restaurants buy and use Spicewell in the kitchens every day.
And you're going to actually have a physical presence here on Wall Street?
Yes. So yes. We also realized that in certain cities where we had restaurants, we needed to have a spice store because people were just coming to the restaurants trying to see where they could buy the spices, you know, because they needed it right away. So in Atlanta and Ponce City Market, we opened our first retail Spicewell store maybe 3 months ago. And in Asheville, we just did a pop-up temporarily while we're building out a location on Wall Street for our permanent store.
And when do you think that may open?
We're the city of Asheville, if you're listening to this, our permits are in.
Crossing the fingers.
Please get those things fast-tracked because we'd love to be open in time for the holiday season, but I'm not sure we will be. But certainly by early next year, our retail store will be open.
Well, I'll send the good vibes.
Thank you.
Anything, I always ask this, anything else on the radar that you want to talk about coming up?
Well, with the sort of recent accolades of Chai Pani, obviously with the James Beard Foundation Award, and also in November of last year, the New York Times put us on their 50 favorite restaurants in America list, there's just a lot of momentum towards us expanding. And right now we're in two cities, and we're fairly certain that in the coming years we'll be in more major metropolitan cities that are, you know, within a certain hub of Asheville, because this is home. I'm not leaving. I want to stay here.
It's pretty nice here. I have to agree with you.
This is home. This is home for me now. And the impetus behind the growing Chai Pani is not because, it's strike while the iron's hot and it's a good financial move. It's actually strike while the iron's hot to really help spread the message of Indian street food far and wide. From day one, as you mentioned in your opening, my mission was to change the way people thought of Indian food. A lot of phenomenal chefs over the last 10 years have now joined that mission. I mean, from Chintan Pandya in New York with his restaurants Adda and Dhamaka and Seema, of course, people like Manith and Chiti and Vish and many, many other great chefs. I mean, Niven Patel down in Miami with Ghee are doing amazing things with Indian food and truly changing the way people think of what Indian food can look like, taste like. And it's important to me because I felt like our culture and our cuisine just deserve more than what Americans had experienced over the last, 20, 30, 40 years of the prior generation of Indian restaurants. And it's also important to me because I think as the world becomes smaller and as cultures collide and integrate with each other, food seems to be the one thing that everybody can kind of get around and agree on. Most of us, our first impression of another culture, our first exposure to another culture is usually through its food. I mean, I didn't know anything about Vietnam, but I certainly had experienced Vietnamese food first. You can almost do a word association game. If I say Japanese, you'll say sushi. You know, if I say, whatever, Peking, you'll say duck. You know, and so food is usually our doorway, our first step towards understanding a different culture.
Absolutely. I've always said that food and music are the great unifiers.
Exactly. So the more Chai Panis we can open, the more people experience Indian street food, the better understanding hopefully they'll have of our culture, our people. There's a lot of us in the United States of America. So, and also, I think just the outstanding part of Chai Pani, and I love the pun because I joke that, we won outstanding because the things that we do are stand outside the restaurant. they're outside the four walls. We want to do that in every community we're in. I truly believe in this idea of, a pebble in a pond causing ripples, and we want to be that pebble in the ponds that we end up in that can spread ripples of giving back, of, growing your team, of just sort of making the world a better place, one plate of Indian street food at a time.
Well, Marwan, thank you so much for your time, and I can't wait to see what's next. I know a lot of people can't.
Oh, thank you so much. It was absolutely a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope the listeners enjoy this conversation.
Thanks for listening to HRN on Tour. You can find all of our programming at heritageradio.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.